So now, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the last but not least panel of the day. And, you know, we have to make sure that we close the day in a very positive note. I have here my colleagues Ben Nolan and Mike Weber. They're heading the Shipping Research Department at Knight Capital and Wells Fargo. So I want to thank them for being with us today. And I'll try to make it actually myself and keep the time. So I will start by asking them, you know, each one of them is producing extensive research on shipping. You know, they're great analysts. They talk to investors all the time. So the first question I'd like to ask you, I have the feeling that investors are not particularly focused right now on shipping stocks. Is that the case, and why is it the case, and what do you think needs to be done as a catalyst so we can get investor interest back on track? So you can, I'll start with
Ben. I'll take it. Well, actually, before I start, I want to thank the bankers who were up here two panels ago for all their nice words about U.S. research. I'm actually not allowed to thank you in person, but I feel like if I thank everyone, you'll get the message. In terms of catalysts to bring shipping kind of back into the forefront for institutional investors, you know, I think at the end of the day, the first and foremost, you're going to need to see a cyclical turn. You know, these stocks are not core to a lot of institutional portfolios. I think it's growing. You definitely have some large institutional investors that definitely follow the space, but there's a pretty big subset that doesn't. And I would say, a turn in the cycle, but B, just time. As investors see these stocks go through multiple cycles, as they get more comfortable with valuation ranges, peaks and troughs, and when they can actually be comfortable jumping in, I think you'll see broader participation among institutional investors in some of these stocks. There's always going to be a premium placed on stronger balance sheets, especially having gone through the super cycle and the crash. But in terms of what can be done, there's no real magic bullet out there. There's nothing that I can think of that would automatically make Fidelity want to go out and buy every Greek shipping company they can find. But they're definitely paying attention. They're monitoring valuations and how these things trend through the cycle. And at some point, I think they are going to become more core. It's just going to take time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the biggest issue is the turn in the cycle, and people have to believe that that their investment horizon is more than or is less than 3 years or however long it is, and that they don't risk coming up with a zero along the way. The one thing that I would add is clearly the majority of the large institutional investors are disengaged almost entirely. I think that the exception is and could potentially be where there are unique ideas and growth opportunities. I think, generally speaking, yield is not enough in most cases to entice institutional investors because most institutional investors don't believe that the yield is permanent. However, if there are interesting ideas that are probably outside of just the normal purview of, you know, dry bulk company X with X number of Handymax vessels or whatever, but things where there is a unique story. I think that unique stories still sell even within the shipping sector, and if there's growth opportunities along that path, I think that you can and we still do find people that are willing to engage.
By the way, we're going to try to cover two areas. One is talk about investor attitudes in shipping, and then, of course, I'd like to ask our experts here about their take on the shipping market and shipping stocks. But on the question of the you know, investor attitudes in shipping, one of the areas that I wanted to bring up, and I hope you will agree with me, is the U.S. has the unique advantage, I think, and others mentioned it before, of having a very high retail participation. So since I have the privilege of dealing with a lot of companies from an investor relations point of view, I hear some owners, they say, I speak to the largest 20 investors. As far as I'm concerned, that's wonderful. But it's not enough. You are in the U.S. that has hundreds or thousands of investors, institutional investors, and millions of retail investors. So you have to have a mechanism in place, I think, that will put out your story the way you describe to a wider universe. Of course, we have to focus on the fidelity of this world. But at the same time, I think the retail investors are very important as well, and I hope you agree with this assessment.
No, I absolutely agree. Again, though, with retail investors, you know, they're going to gravitate towards certain stories. Yield is obviously a huge draw for retail investors. And then you also have a certain faction of retail investors that were very heavily invested in 2007, 2008. So you have a lot of legacy holdings there. So I would say, and we have a very, very built-out retail distribution network, so we actually hear from retail investors quite a bit. And I would say the interest is pretty bifurcated. You have a lot of legacy holders that know the stories very well, that are tracking the cycles and waiting for a turn, and some of them are looking to average down eventually. And then you have the guys that are still out there looking for yield, that are looking, you know, first and foremost at the security of the yield. And we've touched on this a couple different times and on a couple of recent panels. But the security of the dividend yield is certainly growing in importance. It's probably one of the top two or three factors in looking at a stock right now. But there's definitely an appetite. You know, we've had several calls just purely dedicated to our retail network. They're very well attended. There's generally a pretty big appetite and a lot of interest there. But just like with institutional investors, I mean, they're going to care generally about the same things.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and I think clearly at this point the institution or the individual investors and the retail investors make up a larger percentage of the overall holders within almost all of the shipping companies, and so clearly they're probably more important now than they were 2 years ago. To your point about sort of the level of communication and the transparency, I think that's absolutely key, and I think the more or the easier it is for investors, be it retail or institutional, to get comfortable with the management team, to get comfortable with a story, to be able to look at something and quickly make a judgment as to whether or not they have an interest, as opposed to having to do an awful lot of work, I think the better. Nobody has the sector is not so core that anyone has to own it, so you have to. As management teams, you have to present something that's appetizing and appealing, and the more transparent and vocal you can be towards that end, I think the better.
And Nick, someone on an earlier panel, I think it was either Wiley or Eric, mentioned clarity in terms of your distribution message. I think that's spot on. I think that's paramount right now. You look at the names, at least the names that I cover, the names that draw a lot of interest, the names that are actually performing relatively well, both on a relative basis and on an absolute basis, they have a very, very clear distribution message, be that either one that's a non-dividend payer that's focused on growth, or just a clear message in terms of how they're thinking about their dividend, what they're paying, when they're paying it, and what it would take to raise that dividend. Any sort of like a wish-washy attitude, and any sort of indication that there's some sort of vulnerability to the way you're thinking about the distribution is going to end up getting discounted out of the stock. So the companies that have a clean and clean, concise message right now are getting a pretty big premium.
Actually, to go along with what you're saying, it's a shipping conference. We all focus about shipping. That's all we talk about today. But I think to put things in perspective, in the U.S. markets, we have about 47, 48 companies listed in shipping. Aggregate market cap, I think, is less than $30 billion. And so $30 billion in the U.S. capital markets, it's not even a grain, one seed of grain. It's very small. So, and that goes back to your point. I think if you're dealing, and a lot of the companies involved in the sector are small caps, small floats. So if you don't have a very clear and consistent communications policy, I think it's very difficult to get your message across. And I have to say, I admire these guys for being particularly consistent in terms of their research coverage, covering everything that every conference call, every earnings announcement, putting things out. But I think you cannot do it by yourselves. You need the companies to back you up in terms of a clear policy, in terms of communication.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you guys are going to do what you're going to do, and it's our job to comment on it. So, I mean, I would say that in terms of how we're going to interpret your actions, I think that, again, a concise and clear dividend policy, and one that investors can they're going to view that as best they can, as kind of sleep at night money, money that's is going to be giving them 5 or 6 or 7% or greater, and there's not going to be a whole lot of change there. So you know, it's helpful for management teams to be concise and very consistent with their distribution message, and I know it's appreciated by investors.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, it's clearly not our role to be cheerleaders for management teams, but by the same token, if we can make an analytical decision that something is of value or that there's a good idea out there, and along with that, the management teams can put forth a clear and concise message as we talked about, then it does make our jobs that much easier.
Actually, I have two things that I want to ask, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, because I'll also offer my own opinion, so we can all be on the same spot. Two things that you know, come to me professionally all the time are the following. Number one, we all talk about this wonderful opportunity, as we say in every press release, we will take advantage of market opportunities if and when they arise, about accretive expansion and so on. But the reality is, every company today in the U.S. is trading below NAV. So if you need capital and you cannot get the capital from the bank, if you need equity capital, the only way to take advantage of those opportunities is to issue equity at below NAV. Wouldn't that be a killer in terms of, you know, from an investor point of view? I mean, it would be dilutive. At the same time, you issue equity below NAV, but you also invest in assets that may be at a historical low. And people come to me for advice. I have a hard time offering them. I'll tell you what I tell them, but please don't quote me in the press. So what I say is that, you know, if you really have a very good opportunity to invest and you do have a capital increase and everybody participates, nobody gets diluted. The people who get diluted are those who don't participate. Of course, from an analyst point of view, you may look at it differently.
Yeah, and I can't really speak towards or from the perspective of an investment banker, but I will say to the extent that people are trying to issue equity at substantial discounts to NAV in order to fund new growth, that doesn't make a whole lot of analytical sense. I mean, maybe you get a little bit more liquidity in your shares, maybe you get a little bit more market cap that enables it to be more investable, but at the end of the day, it is a down cycle, and so in my view, unless you need it to survive, which is a completely different scenario, it is probably better, and my investment banking friends probably don't appreciate this, but it's probably better to just batten down the hatches and try not to overly dilute your shareholder base to the extent possible, and growth is critical, but not at any cost.
Well, I have a couple things. I mean, one, I think there are definitely stocks in the U.S. that are still trading at significant premiums to NAV. And I would say that, too, you know, NAV can mean a lot of things. It can be interpreted a lot of different ways. Certainly the days right now, you know, the days of raising kind of blind pools of money and going and looking for assets are probably over. That's not to say they couldn't come back. But right now you generally need a deal attached. And to make it accretive to any sort of distribution earnings, you're going to need a charter attached to it as well. So, you know, when you're looking at that NAV, we tend to look at it on a charter inclusive basis, and that can generally skew or be different than what market perception of NAV really is. So I think it comes down to the individual situations. You know, if you have a stock that's, you know, very, very aligned on their dividend, and you can effectively go out and purchase a cash flow stream that's going to be accretive for unit holders or shareholders in the near term, you know, I think that's probably a conversation that's worth having. But again, you know, the NAV is a very, it can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And again, there are absolutely stocks in the U.S. that are trading a significant premium to NAV, and then, you know, it's significant premiums to forward NAV to where we think NAVs are actually headed, which is really what matters.
You're right, Mike, and actually I think these stocks that trade above NAV are the stocks that have a very consistent dividend payment track record and clear visibility in terms of sustainability of those dividends.
Or stocks in a significant amount of distress, yeah.
Correct. Anyway, so let's move now to maybe the shipping markets. But I just wanted to ask you this question because I think everybody talks about these opportunities, and this conference is about capital and how you find capital. And we've heard about bank capital not being very available. We've heard about the capital markets being opened very selectively. Alternative financing is available, but again, under certain caveats. So capital availability, I think, is the question to ask today, particularly as we look at the growth prospects of every company, private or public. Anyway, let's move now to the shipping markets and ask you, being the experts, two things. First of all, what segment of the market do you think is the most beaten up? And what segment of the market has the most potential for a turnaround in the shorter term? Well, and then I can ask you your stock picks.
Sure. I mean, generally, we're probably more bearish on the dry bulk market than any other sector right now, having to do mostly with the low barrier entry and the order book. I mean, these are themes that are not going to surprise anyone in this room. We've been talking about them for the last 4 or 5 years. It's just taking a very long time to play out. We do think eventually there will be a turn, but we think that's measured in years and not quarters. The markets that we're more excited about, obviously, LNG has been very favorable the last year or two. The market that we think is actually poised for a turn and probably going to be turning in 2012, we think is a product tanker market. It's a much thinner publicly traded universe. You only have a handful of stocks that actually have kind of core exposure to product tankers. But when we look at the supply fundamentals there and really the kind of the secular demand catalysts that really get most institutional investors excited, we think the table is set there for a gradual recovery, not something, we don't think we're going to see MRs earning $20,000 a day in the next 6 months on a spot basis. But we do think we're going to see a gradual recovery there, and we think equity investors are starting to appreciate that, especially when they're looking at distributions and they're thinking, well, maybe the minimum earnings capacity for some of these companies is behind them, and maybe if they made it through this far paying a dividend, maybe it's sustainable at this point. So those are the conversations we're having around the product tanker market. Crude tankers, we actually think there's probably the most upside within that market over the next 2 to 3 years. We just think it's a little bit too early. We tend to think we're going to see the start of a cyclical turn, maybe in Q4 this year, maybe 2013. But in terms of equity sentiment, I think if you can make the assumption that Q3 is going to be relatively weak this year, which I think is a pretty easy assumption to make from a rate perspective, you're going to have equity investors that have been out of this space for a couple years. They're going to be looking at evaluations that are still going to be relatively low, and they're going to be looking at they're going to be heading into a period of seasonal strength and then a 2013 environment that they think might be improving. So I get questions all the time from investors about, when do I want to invest in these stocks? I don't want to miss them. I'll ride them out for 6 to 9 months. I just don't want to be too late. I think the back half of this year, specifically kind of heading into Q4, is when you start to see investors really start to do that math, really take a look at some of these stocks and say, okay, well, if I'm 6 months early, that's fine. I'll catch some positive seasonality, and then I'm going to ride this the cyclical upturn. But that's generally how we think about the stocks.
I generally, I don't want to sound I have the same story, but generally I do. The few caveats I would say, I think while I'm not especially fond of either the dry bulk or the crude side, I think I prefer the dry bulk side. The reason is I do think we will see MR rates over $20,000 a day within 6 months on a sustainable level because they're cannibalizing crude trade. And you have these massive refineries being built in Saudi Arabia and India that will come online over the summer and next year. So I'm extremely bullish with respect to the product tanker space. Containers, I think, are longer-term play. I like the liners now, but I think the actual physical assets and the charter rates probably lag substantially an improvement in the liner space because they're rationalizing supply. Just for kind of background, so that covers sort of the scope of the U.S. listed public or the publicly listed names in the U.S. I do actually cover the cap structure, so I'm looking at bonds and private equity and everything. And if I had to pick any one subset of the whole shipping universe, I think my favorite idea from an asset-based perspective is LPG, followed probably by chemical tankers. I think there's a lot of room legs left for the LNG side of the business, I think largely you're not going to find any substantial discounts, be it on the public side or the private side, in the LNG market. So. For private ship owners or ship owners looking to expand into new categories, my advice would be either the larger chemical sector or LPG.
Guys, your research, your recommendations are public. Can I ask you your topics or, you know, I wouldn't say which companies to avoid, so I'd rather focus on the companies.
Sure. Our top picks right now are TK and TK Tankers, heading into potential large-scale tanker drop-down, which we think would be pretty creative for TNK. We've been pretty vocal about that, and we think that happens actually sooner rather than later. I didn't mention the container complex and how I think about the sectors, but it's a much more interesting space right now. Valuations are much better than they were in the last trough, but you're kind of starting to see the same things in terms of vessel layups and kind of quasi-consolidation among the container lines to support freight rates. We do tend to like the box lessors a little bit more than we like the ship owners at this point, but that's more from a secular perspective. We like some of the trends there, but we certainly think there are some pretty interesting value dislocations in the container ship space. We like Costa Mare quite a bit. And then Capital Product Partners on the product tanker side, as I mentioned earlier, we're pretty bullish on that space. And again, that's a relatively thin universe, so it's a pretty small subset of companies there, but we think that distribution is sustainable, and those are all stocks we're long. In terms of names that we're short right now, we're short most of our dry bulk coverage. Just generally based on the fact that there's going to be a lot of distress in the space, we're still on the wrong side of a number of very public restructurings that are probably going to happen over the next couple of months. Those generally tend not to be favorable for current equity investors. That said, I don't think that, you know, we're going to see that entire universe go away. I think there will certainly be a time to own those stocks. I just personally don't think it's now. And I probably won't get into stock-specific sales, just so I don't get thrown out of the room.
Favorite, probably two ideas on the equity side are Scorpio Tankers, another product tanker play. One of many that is trading at a discount to NAV, but you know it's a spot-oriented product tanker play with substantial leverage to market without too much financial leverage. So, just in case I'm wrong, the other one that I would say is sort of an ancillary shipping company is Aegean Marine. The bunker fuel provider. I think that market is starting to turn, and you're seeing margins flatten a bit. And as that happens, I think it's a niche company, but it's somewhat it has been at least somewhat beaten down. In terms of shorts, I'll move out of equities. I think largely you can find some high yield bonds that are unsecured that are trading at pretty close valuations to some relatively similar secured bonds. And there are varying situations and reasons for that. But generally speaking, I think given the overall market, it's hard for me to have any conviction on the buy side for a shipping bond. That is exposed to the cyclicality of the shipping market that's trading at less than 8 or 9%. Unless you have some asset securitizing that bond, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I too will stay away from the public equities on the short side, but I think there are some bonds that are just a little bit too overvalued at the current levels.
And Nick, I don't technically cover the fixed income side, but I would agree. I think there's some high-yield shipping bonds that are unsecured shipping bonds that are pretty grossly overvalued here.
I agree. It's always better to focus on the stuff that we want to own as opposed to the stuff we don't want to own. And with that, maybe we should open it to the audience if you have any questions. Emil, please.
Hello. Just a general question about China. Do you believe that the presence of China, which is continues to increase in the global market for everything, including demand for ships or for freight, and including their construction of vessels, do you think that dynamic is going to change, that factor is going to change the dynamics of the shipping industry over the next 5-10 years? I mean, it's a difficult one to call, but you know, what's your feeling on that?
I would argue it probably already has. And I think certainly from a vessel production standpoint it has, as they continue to build more technically difficult assets and they continue just to throw more supply onto the market. From a demand perspective, we've clearly seen it play out on the dry bulk side. We've really yet to see it play out in a huge way on the tanker side, aside from some kind of ton-mile dislocations in and around West Africa and the AG. But as you start talking about the building of strategic reserves, ramping up that kind of import number from the 5 million barrel a day range to the 7 to 8 to 9 to 10 million barrel a day range, and that could be very meaningful. Obviously from a container perspective as well, kind of the outsourcing of production capacity to Asia and then the importing to Western economies has certainly transformed the containerized trade already.
Yeah, and I would say the more critical analysis to be done, obviously, is looking forward and the order of magnitude to which China can sustain the growth that they have been on. I mean, whether it's GDP forecast of 8.2% or which is off of the low double digit numbers that they had. If we're on a trajectory of call it 5% Chinese GDP, there is the order book on the dry bulk side is 30% of the existing fleet. That would be a problem if China was only growing at 5%. We really and whether it's tankers or containers or dry bulk, I think the market can ill afford a meaningful slowdown in China. Some of the trades are inelastic, but not perfectly inelastic, and a further deterioration of growth in China in a meaningful way. If GDP is 7.5%, I don't think it's the end of the world. But if you do get a substantial slowdown, then China and the impact that they have had will be ancient history.
Any other question? If there are no other questions, then we will call it a day. I will thank my panelists, and I will thank you all for being with us today. It's been a long day, but I hope it was a very productive day. And thank you to everybody for coming, for joining in, and making this great day a great success, as I believe it was. Thank you.